city has a right to a wage 10 times greater than the son of a miner who has grown pale in a mine since the age of 11, or that a weaver has a right to a wage 3 or 4 times greater than that of an agricultural labourer. The cost of teaching a weaver his work is not 4 times greater than the cost of teaching a peasant his. The weaver simply benefits by the advantages his industry reaps in international trade from countries that have as yet no industries, and in consequence of the privileges accorded by all states to industries in preference to the tilling of the soil. Nobody has ever calculated the cost of production of a producer. And if a noble loafer costs far more to society than a worker, it remains to be seen whether a robust day laborer does not cost more to society than a skilled artisan, when you have taken into account infant mortality among the poor, the ravages of anemia, and premature deaths. Could they, for example, make us believe that the 1s 3d paid to a Paris workman, the 3d paid to an Auvergne peasant girl who grows blind at lace making, or the 1s 8d paid to the peasant represent their cost of production? We know full well that people work for less, but we also know that they do so exclusively because, thanks to our wonderful organization, they would die of hunger did they not accept these mock wages. For us, the scale of remuneration is a complex result of taxes, of governmental tutelage, of capitalist monopoly, in a word, of state and capital. Therefore, we say that all wages theories have been invented after the event to justify injustices at present existing, and that we did not take them into consideration. Neither will they fail to tell us that the collectivist scale of wages would be an improvement. It would be better, so they say, to see certain artisans receiving a wage 2 or 3 times higher than common laborers, than to see a minister receiving in a day what a workman cannot earn in a year. It would be a great step towards equality. For us, this step would be the reverse of progress. To make a distinction between simple and professional work in a new society would result in the revolution sanctioning and recognizing as a principle a brutal fact we submit to nowadays, but that we nevertheless find unjust. It would mean imitating those gentlemen of the French Assembly who proclaim on August 4, 1789, the abolition of feudal rights, but who on August 8 sanctioned these same rights by imposing dues on the peasants to compensate the noblemen, placing these Jews under the protection of a revolution. It would mean imitating the Russian government, which proclaimed at the time of the emancipation of the serfs that certain lands should henceforth belong to the nobility, while formerly these lands were considered as belonging to the serfs. Or else, to take a better known example, when the Commune of 1871 decided to pay members of the Commune Council 12s 6d a day, while the federates on the ramparts received only 1s 3d, this decision was hailed as an act of superior democratic equality. In reality, the Commune only ratified the former inequality between functionary and soldier, government and governed. Coming from an opportunist chamber of deputies, such a decision would have appeared admirable, but the Commune doomed her own revolutionary principles when she failed to put them into practice. Under our existing social system, when a minister gets paid £4,000 a year, while a workman must content himself with £40 or less, when a foreman is paid 2 or 3 times more than a workman, and among workmen there is every gradation from 8s a day down to the peasant girl's 3d, we disapprove of the high salary of the minister, as well as of the difference between the 8s of the workman and the 3d of the poor woman, and we say, down with the privileges of education, as well as with those of birth. We are anarchists precisely because these privileges revolt us. They revolt us already in this authoritarian society. Could we endure them in a society that began by proclaiming equality? This is why some collectivists, understanding the impossibility of maintaining a scale of wages in a society inspired by the breath of a revolution, hasten to proclaim equality of wage, but they meet with new difficulties, and their equality of wages becomes the same unrealizable utopia as the scale of wages of other collectivists. A society having taken possession of all social wealth, having boldly proclaimed the right of all to this wealth, whatever share they may have taken in producing it, will be compelled to abandon any system of wages, whether in currency or labor notes. Part 4. The collectivists say, to each according to his deeds, or in other terms, according to his share of services rendered to society. They think it expedient to put this principle into practice as soon as the social revolution will have made all instruments of production common property. But we think that if the social revolution had the misfortune of proclaiming such a principle, it would mean its necessary failure. It would mean leaving the social problem, which past centuries have burdened us with, unsolved. Of course, in a society like ours, in which the more a man works the less he is remunerated, this principle, at first sight, may appear to be a yearning for justice, but in reality it is only the perpetuation of injustice. It was by proclaiming this principle that wagedom began to end in the glaring inequalities and all the abominations of present society. Because from the moment work done began to be appraised in currency, or in any other form of wage, the day it was agreed upon that man would only receive the wage he should be able to secure to himself, the whole history of a state-aided capitalist society was as good as written. It was contained in germ in this principle. Shall we then return to our starting point and go through the same evolution again? Our theorists desire it, but fortunately it is impossible. The revolution, we maintain, must be communist. If not, it will be drowned in blood and have to be begun over again. Services rendered to society, be they work in factory or field, or mental services, cannot be valued in money. There can be no exact measure of value, open bracket, of what has been wrongly termed exchange value, close bracket, nor of use value, in terms of production. If two individuals work for the community 5 hours a day, year in, year out, at different work which is equally agreeable to them, we may say that on the whole, their labor is approximately equivalent, but we cannot divide their work and say that the result of any particular day, hour, or minute of work of the one is worth the result of 1 day, 1 hour, or 1 minute of the other. We may roughly say that the man who during his lifetime has deprived himself of leisure during 10 hours a day has given far more to society than the one who has only deprived himself of leisure during 5 hours a day, or who has not deprived himself at all. But we cannot take what he has done during 2 hours and say that the yield of his 2 hours' work is worth twice as much as the yield of another individual who has worked only 1 hour, and remunerate the two in proportion. It would be disregarding all that is complex in industry, in agriculture, in the whole life of present society. It would be ignoring to what extent all individual work is the result of the past and the present labor of society as a whole. It would mean believing ourselves to be living in the Stone Age, whereas we are living in an age of steel. If you enter a modern coal mine, you will see a man in charge of a huge machine that raises and lowers a cage. In his hand, he holds a lever that stops and reverses the course of the machine. He lowers it and the cage reverses its course in the twinkling of an eye. He sends it upwards or downwards into the depths of the shaft with a giddy swiftness. All attention he follows with his eyes fixed on an indicator which shows him, on a small scale, at which point of the shaft the cage is at each second of its progress. And as soon as the indicator has reached a certain level, he suddenly stops the course of the cage, not a yard higher nor lower than the required spot. And no sooner have the colliers unloaded their coal wagonettes and pushed empty ones instead than he reverses the lever and again sends the cage back into space. During 8 or 10 consecutive hours every day, he must keep the same strain of attention. Should his brain relax for a moment, the cage would inevitably strike against the gear, break its wheels, snap the rope, crush men, and put a stop to all work in the mine. Should he waste 3 seconds at each touch of the lever, the extraction in our modern, perfected mines would be reduced from 20 to 50 tons a day. Is it he who is the most necessary man in the mine? Or is it perhaps the boy who signals to him from below to raise the cage? Is it the miner at the bottom of the shaft who risks his life every instant and who will someday be killed by fire damp? Or is it the engineer who would lose the layer of coal and would cause the miners to dig on rock by a simple mistake in his calculation? Or is it the mine owner who has put his capital into the mine, and who has perhaps, contrary to expert advice, asserted that excellent coal would be found there? All those who are engaged in the mine contribute to the extraction of coal in proportion to their strength, their energy, their knowledge, their intelligence and their skill, and we may say that all have a right to live, to satisfy their needs and even their whims, when the necessaries of life have been secured for all. But how can we appraise the work of each one of them? And moreover, is the coal they have extracted entirely their work? Is it not also the work of the men who have built the railway leading to the mine, and the roads that radiate from all the railway stations? Is it not also the work of those who have tilled and sown the fields, extracted iron, cut wood in the forests, built the machines that burn coal, slowly developed the mining industry altogether, and so on? It is utterly impossible to draw a distinction between the work of each of those men. To measure the work by its results lead us to an absurdity. To divide the total work and to measure its fractions by the number of hours spent on the work also leads us to absurdity. One thing remains, to put the needs above the works, and first of all to recognize the right to live, and later on the right to well-being for all those who took their share in production. But take any other branch of human activity, take the manifestations of life as a whole. Which one of us can claim the higher remuneration for his work? Is it the doctor who has found out the illness, or the nurse who has brought about recovery by her hygienic care? Is it the inventor of the first steam engine, or the boy who one day, getting tired of pulling the rope that formerly opened the valve to let steam under the piston, tied the rope to the lever of the machine, without suspecting that he had invented the essential mechanical part of all modern machinery, the automatic valve? Is it the inventor of a locomotive, or the workman of Newcastle, who suggested replacing the stones formerly laid under the rails by wooden sleepers, as the stones, for want of elasticity, caused the trains to derail? Is it the engineer on the locomotive, the signalman who stops the train, or lets them pass by, the switchman who transfers a train from one line to another? Again, to whom do we owe the transatlantic cable? Is it to the electrical engineer who obstinately affirmed that the cable would transmit messages while learned men of science declared it to be impossible? Is it to Maury, the learned physical geographer, who advised that thick cables should be set aside for others as thin as a walking cane? Or else to those volunteers, come from nobody knows where, who spend their days and nights on deck, minutely examining every yard of the cable and remove the nails that the shareholders of steamship companies stupidly caused to be driven into the non-conducting wrapper of the cable, so as to make it unserviceable? And in a wider sphere, the true sphere of life, with its joys, with its sufferings and its accidents, cannot each one of us recall someone who has rendered him so great a service that we should be indignant if its equivalent in coin were mentioned? The service may have been but a word, nothing but a word spoken at the right time, or else it may have been months and years of devotion, and we are going to appraise these incalculable services in labor notes, the works of each. But human society would not exist for more than two consecutive generations if everyone did not give infinitely more than that for which he is paid in coin, in checks, or in civic rewards. The race would soon become extinct if mothers did not sacrifice their lives to take care of their children, if men did not give continually without demanding an equivalent reward, if men did not give most precisely when they expect no reward, if middle-class society is decaying, if we have got into a blind alley from which we cannot emerge without attacking past institutions with torch and hatchet. It is precisely because we have given too much to counting. It is because we have let ourselves be influenced into giving only to receive. It is because we have aim at turning society into a commercial company based on debit and credit. After all, the collectivists know this themselves. They vaguely understand that a society could not exist if it carried out the principle of each according to his deeds. They have a notion that necessaries, we do not speak of whims, the needs of the individual, do not always correspond to his works. Thus the Pape tells us, the principle, the eminently individualist principle, would however be tempered by social intervention for the education of children and young persons, including maintenance and lodging, and by the social organization for assisting the infirm and the sick, for retreats for aged workers, etc. They understand that a man of 40, father of three children, has other needs than a young man of 20. They know that the woman who suckles her infant and spends sleepless nights at its bedside cannot do as much work as the man who has slept peacefully. They seem to take in that men and women, worn out maybe by need of overwork for society, may be incapable of doing as much work as those who have spent their time leisurely and pocketed their labor notes in the privileged career of state functionaries. They are eager to temper their principle. They say, society will not fail to maintain and bring up its children, to help both aged and infirm. Without doubt, needs will be the measure of the cost that society will burden itself with, to temper the principle of deeds. Charity, charity, always Christian charity, organized by the state this time. They believe in improving the asylums for foundlings, in effecting old age and sick insurances, so as to temper their principle, but they cannot yet throw aside the idea of wounding first and healing afterwards. Thus, after having denied communism, after having laughed at their ease at the formulae, to each according to his needs, these great economists discover that they have forgotten something, the needs of the producers, which they now admit. Only it is for the state to estimate them, for the state to verify if the needs are not disproportionate to the work. The state will dole out charity. Thence to the English poor law and the workhouse is but a step. There is but a slight difference, because even this stepmother of a society, against whom we are in revolt, has also been compelled to temper her individualist principles. She too has had to make concessions in a communist direction, and under the same form of charity. She too distributes halfpenny dinners to prevent the pillaging of her shops, builds hospitals, often very bad ones, but sometimes splendid ones, to prevent the ravages of contagious diseases. She too, after having paid the hours of labor, shelters the children of those she has wrecked. She takes their needs into consideration, and does out charity. Poverty, we have said elsewhere, was the primary cause of wealth. It was poverty that created the first capitalists, because before accumulating surplus value, of which we hear so much, men had to be sufficiently destitute to consent to sell their labor, so as not to die of hunger. It was poverty that made capitalists, and if the number of the poor increased so rapidly during the Middle Ages, it was due to the invasions and wars that followed the founding of states, and to the increase of riches resulting from the exploitation of the East. These two causes tore asunder the bonds that kept men together in the agrarian and urban communities, and told them to proclaim the principle of wages, so dear to the exploiters, instead of the solidarity they formerly practiced in their tribal life. And it is this principle that is to spring from a revolution which men dare to call by the name of social revolution, a name so dear to the starved, the oppressed and the sufferers. It can never be, for the day on which all institutions will fall under the proletarian axe, voices will cry out, bread, shelter, ease for all, and those voices will be listened to. The people will say, let us begin by allaying our thirst for life, for happiness, for liberty, that we have never quenched, and when we shall have tasted of this joy, we will set to work to demolish the last vestiges of middle-class rule, its morality drawn from account books, its debit and credit philosophy, its mine and yours institutions. In demolishing, we shall build, as Proudhon said, and we shall build in the name of communism and anarchy. Chapter 14. Consumption and Production. Part 1. Looking at society and its political organization from a different standpoint than that of all the authoritarian schools, for we start from a free individual to reach a free society, instead of beginning by the state to come down to the individual, we follow the same method in economic questions. We study the needs of the individuals and the means by which they satisfy them, before discussing production, exchange, taxation, government, and so on. At first sight, the difference may appear trifling, but in reality it upsets all the canons of official political economy. If you open the works of any economist, you will find that he begins with production, that is, by the analysis of the means employed nowadays for the creation of wealth, the division of labor, the factory, its machinery, the accumulation of capital. From Adam Smith to Marx, all have proceeded along these lines. Only in the latter parts of their books do they treat of consumption, that is to say, of the means resorted to in our present society to satisfy the needs of the individuals, and even there they confine themselves to explaining how riches are divided among those who vie with one another for their possession. Perhaps you will say this is logical. Before satisfying needs, you must create the wherewithal to satisfy them. But before producing anything, must you not feel the need of it? Was it not necessity that first drove men to hunt, to raise cattle, to cultivate land, to make implements, and later on to invent machinery? Is it not the study of the needs that should govern production, to say the least? It would therefore be quite as logical to begin by considering the needs, and afterwards to discuss how production is and ought to be organized in order to satisfy these needs. This is precisely what we mean to do. But as soon as we look at political economy from this point of view, it entirely changes its aspect. It ceases to be a simple description of facts and becomes a science. And we may define this science as the study of the needs of mankind and the means of satisfying them with the least possible waste of human energy. Its true name should be physiology of society. It constitutes a parallel science to the physiology of plants and animals, which is the study of the needs of plants and animals and of the most advantageous ways of satisfying them. In the series of sociological sciences, the economy of human societies takes the place occupied in the series of biological sciences by the physiology of organic bodies. We say, here are human beings, united in a society. All of them feel the need of living in healthy houses. The savage hut no longer satisfies them. They require a more or less comfortable, solid shelter. The question is then, whether taking the present capacity of men for production, every man can have a house of his own, and what is hindering him from having it? And as soon as we ask this question, we see that every family in Europe could perfectly well have a comfortable house, such as are built in England, in Belgium, or in Pullman City, or else an equivalent set of rooms. A certain number of days' work would suffice to build a pretty little airy house, well fitted up and lighted by electricity. But 9/10 of Europeans have never possessed a healthy house, because at all times common people have had to work day and day to satisfy the needs of their rulers, and have never had the necessary leisure or money to build or to have built. the home of their dreams, and they can have no houses and will inhabit hovels as long as present conditions remain unchanged. It is thus seen that our method is quite contrary to that of the economists, who immortalize the so-called laws of production, and reckoning up the number of houses built every year, demonstrate by statistics that as the number of the new built houses is too small to meet all demands, 9/10 of Europeans must live in hovels. Let us pass on to food. After having enumerated the benefits accruing from the division of labor, economists tell us the division of labor requires that some men should work at agriculture and others at manufacture. Farmers producing so much, factories so much, exchange being carried on in such a way, they analyze the sale, the profit, the net gain, or the surplus value, the wages, the taxes, banking, and so on. But after having followed them so far, we are none the wiser, and if we ask them, how is it that millions of human beings are in want of bread, when every family could grow sufficient wheat to feed 10, 20, and even 100 people annually? They answer us by droning the same anthem, division of labor, wages, surplus value, capital, etc., arriving at the same conclusion that production is insufficient to satisfy all needs, a conclusion which, if true, does not answer the question, can or cannot man by his labor produce the bread he needs? And if he cannot, what is it that hinders him? Here are 350 million Europeans. They need so much bread, so much meat, wine, milk, eggs, and butter every year. They need so many houses, so much clothing. This is the minimum of their needs. Can they produce all this? And if they can, will sufficient leisure be left them for art, science, and amusement? In a word, for everything that is not comprised in the category of absolute necessities? If the answer is in the affirmative, what hinders them going ahead? What must they do to remove the obstacles? Is it time that is needed to achieve such a result? Let them take it, but let us not lose sight of the aim of production, the satisfaction of the needs of all. If the most imperious needs of men remain unsatisfied now, what we must do to increase the productivity of our work? But is there no other course? Might it not be that production, having lost sight of the needs of men, has strayed in an absolutely wrong direction, and that its organization is at fault? And as we can prove that such is the case, let us see how to reorganize production so as to really satisfy all needs. This seems to us the only right way of facing things, the only way that would allow of political economy becoming a science, the science of social physiology. It is evident that so long as science treats of production as it is carried on at present by civilized nations, by Hindu communes, or by savages, it can hardly state facts otherwise than the economist states them now, that is to say, as a simple descriptive chapter, analogous to the descriptive chapters of zoology and botany. But if this chapter were written so as to throw some light on the economy of the energy that is necessary to satisfy human needs, the chapter would gain in precision as well as in descriptive value. It would clearly show the frightful waste of human energy under the present system, and it would prove that as long as this system exists, the needs of humanity will never be satisfied. The point of view we see would be entirely changed. Behind the loom that weaves so many yards of cloth, behind the steel plate perforator, and behind the safe in which dividends are hoarded, we should see man, the artisan of production, more often than not, excluded from the feast he has prepared for others. We should also understand that the standpoint being wrong, the so-called laws of value and exchange are but a very false explanation of the events as they happen nowadays, and that things will come to pass very differently when production is organized in such a manner as to meet all needs of society. Part 2. There is not one single principle of political economy that does not change its aspect if you look at it from our point of view. Take for instance overproduction, a word which every day re-echoes in our ears. Is there a single economist, academician, or candidate for academical honors who has not supported arguments proving that economic crises are due to overproduction, that at a given moment more cotton, more cloth, more watches are produced than are needed? Have we not all of us thundered against the rapacity of the capitalists who are obstinately bent on producing more than can possibly be consumed? However, on careful examination, all these reasonings prove unsound. In fact, is there one single commodity among those in universal use which is produced in greater quantity than need be? Examine one by one all commodities sent out by countries exporting on a large scale, and you will see that nearly all are produced in insufficient quantities for the inhabitants of the countries exporting them. It is not a surplus of wheat that the Russian peasant sends to Europe. The most plentiful harvest of wheat and rye in Europe and Russia only yield enough for the population, and as a rule, the peasant deprives himself of what he actually needs when he sells his wheat or rye to pay rent and taxes. It is not a surplus of coal that England sends to the four corners of the globe, because only three quarters of it return per head of population annually remains for home domestic consumption, and millions of Englishmen are deprived of fire in the winter, or have only just enough to boil a few vegetables. In fact, setting aside useless luxuries, there is in England, which exports more than any other country, one single commodity in universal use, cottons, whose production is sufficiently great to perhaps exceed the needs of a community. Yet when we look upon the rags that pass for wearing apparel worn by over a third of the inhabitants of the United Kingdom, we are led to ask ourselves whether the cotton exported would not on the whole suit the real needs of the population. As a rule, it is not a surplus that is exported, though it may have been so originally. The fable of the barefooted shoemaker is as true of nations as it was formerly of individual artisans. We export the necessary commodities, and we do so because the workmen cannot buy with their wages what they have produced, and pay besides the rent and interest to the capitalist and the banker. Not only does the ever-growing need of comfort remain unsatisfied, but the strict necessities of life are often wanting. Therefore, surplus production does not exist, at least not in the sense given to it by the theorists of political economy. Taking another point, all economists tell us that there is a well-proved law: man produces more than he consumes. After he has lived on the proceeds of his toil, there remains a surplus. Thus, a family of cultivators produces enough to feed several families, and so forth. For us, this oft-repeated sentence has no sense. If it meant that each generation leaves something to future generations, it would be true. Thus, for example, a farmer plants a tree that will live maybe for 30, 40, or 100 years, and whose fruits will still be gathered by the farmer's grandchildren. Or he clears a few acres of virgin soil, and we say that the heritage of future generations has been increased by that much. Roads, bridges, canals, his house and his furniture are so much wealth bequeathed to succeeding generations. But this is not what is meant. We are told that the cultivator produces more than he need consume. Rather, should they say that the state, having always taken from him a large share of his produce for taxes, the price for tithe, and the landlord for rent, a whole class of men has been created who formerly consume what they produce, save what was set aside for unforeseen accidents or expenses incurred in afforestation, roads, etc., but who today are compelled to live very poorly from hand to mouth, the remainder having been taken from them by the state, the landlord, the priest, and the usurer. Therefore, we prefer to say, the agricultural laborer, the industrial worker, and so on, consume less than they produce, because they are compelled to sell most of the produce of their labor, and to be satisfied with but a small portion of it. Let us also observe that if the needs of the individual are taken as the starting point of our political economy, we cannot fail to reach communism, an organization which enables us to satisfy all needs in the most thorough and economical way. While if we start from our present method of production and aim at gain and surplus value without asking whether our production corresponds to the satisfaction of needs, we necessarily arrive at capitalism, or at most at collectivism, both being the two different forms of the present wages system. In fact, when we consider the needs of the individual and of society, and the means which man has resorted to in order to satisfy them during his varied phases of development, we see at once the necessity of systemizing our efforts instead of producing haphazard as we do nowadays. It becomes evident that the appropriation by a few of all riches not consumed and transmitted from one generation to another is not in the general interest, and we see as a fact that owing to these methods, the needs of three quarters of society are not satisfied, so that the present waste of human strength in useless things is only the more criminal. We discover, moreover, that the most advantageous use of all commodities would be for each of them to go first for satisfying those needs which are the most pressing, that in other words, the so-called value in use of a commodity does not depend on a simple whim, as has often been affirmed, but on the satisfaction it brings to real needs. Communism, that is to say, an organization which would correspond to a view of consumption, production and exchange, taken as a whole, therefore becomes the logical consequence of such a comprehension of things, the only one in our opinion that is really scientific. A society that will satisfy the needs of all, and which will know how to organize production to answer to this aim, will also have to make a clean sweep of several prejudices concerning industry, and first of all the theory often preached by economists, the division of labor theory, which we are going to discuss in the next chapter. Chapter 15, the division of labor. Political economy has always confined itself to stating facts occurring in society and justifying them in the interest of the dominant class. Therefore it pronounces itself in favor of the division of labor in industry. Having found it profitable to capitalists, it has set it up as a principle. "Look at the village smith," said Adam Smith, the father of modern political economy. "If he has never been accustomed to making nails, he will only succeed by hard toil in forging 200 or 300 a day, and even then they will be bad. But if this same smith has never made anything but nails, he will easily supply as many as 2,300 in the course of a day." And Smith hastened to the conclusion, "Divide labor, specialize, go on specializing. Let us have smiths who only know how to make heads or points of nails, and by this means we shall produce more, we shall grow rich." That a smith condemned for life to make the heads of nails would lose all interest in his work, that he would be entirely at the mercy of his employer with his limited handicraft, that he would be out of work for months out of 12, and that his wages would fall very low down when it would be easy to replace him by an apprentice, Smith did not think of all this when he exclaimed, "Long live the division of labor! This is the real gold mine that will enrich the nation." And all joined him in this cry. And later on, when a Sismondi or a GBC began to understand that the division of labor, instead of enriching the whole nation, only enriches the rich, and that the worker who is doomed for life to making the 18th part of a pin grows stupid and sinks into poverty, what did official economists propose? Nothing. They did not say to themselves that by a lifelong grind at one and the same mechanical toil, the worker would lose his intelligence and his spirit of invention, and that on the contrary, a variety of occupations would result in considerably augmenting the productivity of a nation. But this is the very issue we have now to consider. If, however, learned economists were the only ones to preach the permanent and often hereditary division of labor, we might allow them to preach it as much as they pleased. But the ideas taught by doctors of science filter into men's minds and pervert them, and from repeatedly hearing the division of labor, profits, interest, credit, etc., spoken of as problems long since solved, all middle-class people, and workers too, and by arguing like economists, they venerate the same fetishes. Thus we see most socialists, even those who have not feared to point out the mistakes of economical science, justifying the division of labor. Talk to them about the organization of work during the revolution, and they answer that the division of labor must be maintained, but if you sharpen pins before the revolution, you must go on sharpening them after. True, you will not have to work more than 5 hours a day, but you will have to sharpen pins all your life, while others will make designs for machines that will enable you to sharpen hundreds of millions of pins during your lifetime, and others again will be specialists in the higher branches of literature, science and art, etc. You were born to sharpen pins, while Pasteur was born to invent the inoculation against anthrax, and the revolution will leave you both to your respective employments. Well, it is this horrible principle, so noxious to society, so brutalizing to the individual, source of so much harm, that we propose to discuss in its diverse manifestations. We know the consequences of the division of labor full well. It is evident that, first of all, we are divided into two classes. On the one hand, producers who consume very little and are exempt from thinking because they only do physical work, and who work badly because their brains remain inactive, and on the other hand, the consumers who producing little or hardly anything have the privilege of thinking for the others, and who think badly because the whole world of those who toil with their hands is unknown to them. Then we have the laborers of the soil, who know nothing of machinery, while those who work at machinery ignore everything about agriculture. The idea of modern industry is a child tending a machine that he cannot and must not understand, and a foreman who finds him, if his attention flags for a moment. The ideal of industrial agriculture is to do away with the agricultural laborer altogether, and to set a man who does odd jobs to tend a steam plough or a threshing machine. The division of labor means labeling and stamping men for life, some to splice ropes in factories, some to be foremen in a business, others to shove huge coal baskets in a particular part of a mine, but none of them to have any idea of machinery as a whole, nor of business, nor of mines, and thereby they destroy the love of work and the capacity for invention that, at the beginning of modern industry, created the machinery on which we pride ourselves so much. What they have done for individuals, they also wanted to do for nations. Humanity was to be divided into national workshops, having each its speciality. Russia, we were taught, was destined by nature to grow corn, England to spin cotton, Belgium to weave cloth, while Switzerland was to train nurses and governesses. Moreover, each separate city was to establish a specialty. Lyon was to weave silk, Auvergne to make lace, and Paris fancy articles. In this way, economists said, an immense field was opened for production and consumption, and in this way an era of limitless wealth for mankind was at hand. However, these great hopes vanished as fast as technical knowledge spread abroad. As long as England stood alone as a weaver of cotton and as a metal worker on a large scale, as long as only Paris made artistic fancy articles, etc., all went well. Economists could preach the so-called division of labor without being refuted. But a new current of thought induced by and by all civilized nations to manufacture for themselves. They found it advantageous to produce what they formerly received from other countries or from their colonies, which in their turn aimed at emancipating themselves from the mother country. Scientific discoveries universalized the methods of production, and henceforth it was useless to pay an exorbitant price abroad for what could easily be produced at home. And now we see already that this industrial revolution strikes a crushing blow at the theory of the division of labor, which for a long time was supposed to be so sound. Chapter 16. The decentralization of industry. (Footnote: A fuller development of these ideas will be found in my book, Fields, Factories and Workshops, published by Mrs. Thomas Nelson and Sons in the popular series in 1912. (Footnote: Part 1.) After the Napoleonic Wars, Britain had nearly succeeded in ruining the main industries which had sprung up in France at the end of the preceding century. She also became mistress of the seas and had no rivals of importance. She took in the situation and knew how to turn its privileges and advantages to account. She established an industrial monopoly and, imposing upon her neighbors her prices for the goods she alone could manufacture, accumulated riches upon riches. But as the middle class revolution of the 18th century had abolished serfdom and created a proletariat in France, French industry, hampered for a time in its flight, soared again, and from the second half of the 19th century, France ceased to be a tributary of England for manufactured goods. Today, she too has grown into a nation with an export trade. She sells far more than £60 million worth of manufactured goods, and two-thirds of these goods are fabrics. The number of Frenchmen working for export or living by their foreign trade is estimated at 3 million. France is therefore no longer England's tributary. In her turn, she has striven to monopolize certain branches of foreign industry, such as silks and ready-made clothes, and has reaped immense profits therefrom. But she is on the point of losing this monopoly forever, just as England is on the point of losing the monopoly of cotton goods. Travelling eastwards, industry has reached Germany. 50 years ago, Germany was a tributary of England and France for most manufactured commodities in the higher branches of industry. It is no longer so. In the course of the last 50 years, and especially since the Franco-German War, Germany has completely reorganized her industry. The new factories are stocked with the best machinery, the latest creations of industrial art in cotton goods from Manchester, or in silks from Lyon, etc., are now realized in new German factories. It took 2 or 3 generations of workers at Lyon and Manchester to construct the modern machinery, but Germany adopted it in its perfected state. Technical schools, adapted to the needs of industry, supply the factories with an army of intelligent workmen, practical engineers who can work with both hand and brain. German industry starts at the point which was only reached by Manchester and Lyon after 50 years of groping in the dark, of exertion and experiments. It follows that since Germany manufactures so well at home, she diminishes her imports from France and England year by year. She has not only become their rival in manufactured goods in Asia and in Africa, but also in London and in Paris. Short-sighted people in France may cry out against the Frankfurt Treaty. English manufacturers may explain German competition by little difference in railway tariffs. They may linger on the petty side of questions and neglect great historical facts. But it is nonetheless certain that the main industries, formerly in the hands of England and France, have progressed eastward. And in Germany they have found a country, young, full of energy, possessing an intelligent middle class, and eager in its turn to enrich itself by foreign trade. While Germany has freed itself from subjection to France and England, has manufactured her own cotton cloth and constructed her own machines, in fact manufactured all commodities, the main industries have also taken root in Russia, where the development of manufacture is the more constructive as it sprang up but yesterday. At the time of the abolition of serfdom in 1861, Russia had hardly any factories. Everything needed in the way of machines, rails, railway engines, fine dress materials came from the West. 20 years later, she possessed already 85,000 factories, and the value of the goods manufactured in Russia had increased fourfold. The old machinery was superseded, and now nearly all the steel in use in Russia, three-quarters of the iron, two-thirds of the coal, all railway engines, railway carriages, rails, nearly all steamers, are made in Russia. Russia, destined, so wrote economists, to remain an agricultural territory, has rapidly developed into a manufacturing country. She orders hardly anything from England, and very little from Germany. Economists hold the customs responsible for these facts, and yet cottons manufactured in Russia are sold at the same price as in London, capital taking no cognizance of fatherlands, German and English capitalists, accompanied by engineers and foremen of their own nationalities, have introduced in Russia and in Poland manufacturers whose goods compete in excellence with the best from England. If customs were abolished tomorrow, manufacture would only gain by it. Not long ago, the British manufacturers delivered another hard blow to the import of cloth and woolens from the West. They set up in southern and middle Russia immense wool factories stocked with the most perfect machinery from Bradford, and already now Russia imports only the highest sorts of cloth and woolen fabrics from England, France and Austria. The remainder is fabricated at home, both in factories and as domestic industries. The main industries not only move eastward, they are spreading also to the southern peninsulas. The Turin exhibition of 1884 already demonstrated the progress made in Italian manufactured produce, and let us not make any mistake about it. The mutual hatred of the French and Italian middle classes has no other origin than their industrial rivalry. Spain is also becoming an industrial country, while in the East, Bohemia has suddenly sprung into importance as a new center of manufactures, provided with perfected machinery and applying the best scientific methods. We might also mention Hungary's rapid progress in the main industries, but let us rather take Brazil as an example. Economists sentence Brazil to cultivate cotton forever, to export it in its raw state, and to receive cotton cloth from Europe in exchange. In fact, 40 years ago, Brazil had only 9 rich little cotton factories with 385 spindles. Today there are 160 cotton mills possessing 1,500,000 spindles and 50,000 looms, which throw 500 million yards of textiles on the market annually. Even Mexico is now very successful in manufacturing cotton cloth instead of importing it from Europe. As to the United States, they have quite freed themselves from European tutelage and have triumphantly developed their manufacturing powers to an enormous extent. But it was India which gave the most striking proof against the specialization of national industry. We all know the theory: the great European nations need colonies, for colonies send raw material, cotton fiber and wash wool, spices, etc., to the motherland. And the motherland, under pretense of sending them manufactured wares, gets rid of her damaged stuff, her machine scrap iron, and everything which she no longer has any use for. It costs her little or nothing, and nonetheless the articles are sold at exorbitant prices. Such was the theory, such was the practice for a long time. In London and Manchester, fortunes were made, while India was being ruined. In the India Museum in London, unheard of riches, collected in Calcutta and Bombay by English merchants, are to be seen. But other English merchants and capitalists conceive a very simple idea that it would be more expedient to exploit the natives of India by making cotton cloth in India itself than to import from 20 to 24 million pounds worth of goods annually. At first, a series of experiments ended in failure. Indian weavers, artists and experts in their own craft could not inure themselves to factory life. The machinery sent from Liverpool was bad. The climate had to be taken into account, and merchants had to adapt themselves to new conditions, now fully mastered, before British India could become the menacing rival of the motherland she is today. She now possesses more than 200 cotton mills, which employ about 230,000 workmen, and contain more than 6 million spindles and 80,000 looms, and 40 jute mills with 400,000 spindles. She exports annually to China, to the Dutch Indies and to Africa nearly 8 million pounds worth of the same white cotton cloth, said to be England's speciality. And while English workmen are often unemployed and in great want, Indian women weave cotton by machinery for the Far East at wages of 6 pence a day. In short, the intelligent manufacturers are fully aware that the day is not far off when they will know what to do with the factory hands who formerly wove cotton cloth for export from England. Besides, which it is becoming more and more evident that India will not import a single ton of iron from England. The initial difficulties in using the coal and the iron ore obtained in India have been overcome, and foundries rivaling those in England have been built on the shores of the Indian Ocean. Colonies competing with the motherland in its production of manufactured goods, such is the factor which will regulate economy in the 20th century. And why should India not manufacture? What should be the hindrance? Capital? But capital goes wherever there are men, poor enough to be exploited. Knowledge? But knowledge recognizes no national barriers. Technical skill of the worker? No. Are then Hindu workmen inferior to the hundreds of thousands of boys and girls not 18 years old at present working in the English textile factories? Part 2. After having glanced at national industries, it would be very interesting to turn to some special branches. Let us take silk, for example, an eminently French produce in the first half of the 19th century. We all know how Lyons became the emporium of the silk trade. At first, raw silk was gathered in southern France, till little by little they ordered it from Italy, from Spain, from Austria, from the Caucasus, and from Japan, for the manufacture of their silk fabrics. In 1875, out of 5 million kilos of raw silk converted into stuffs in the vicinity of Lyons, there were only 400,000 kilos of French silk. But if Lyons manufactured imported silk, why should not Switzerland, Germany, Russia do as much? Consequently, silk weaving began to develop in the villages around Zurich. Bale became a great center of the silk trade. The Caucasian administration engaged women from Marseille and workmen from Lyons to teach Georgians the perfected rearing of silkworms and the art of converting silk into fabrics to the Caucasian peasants. Austria followed, then Germany, with the help of Lyons workmen, built great silk factories. The United States did likewise at Paterson, and today the silk trade is no longer a French monopoly. Silks are made in Germany, in Austria, in the United States, and in England, and it is now reckoned that one-third of the silk stuffs used in France are imported. In winter, Caucasian peasants weave silk handkerchiefs at a wage that would mean starvation to the silk weavers of Lyons. Italian Germany sent silks to France, and Lyons, which in 1870-4 exported 460 million francs worth of silk fabrics, exports now only one half of that amount. In fact, the time is not far off when Lyons will only send higher class goods and a few novelties as patterns to Germany, Russia and Japan. And so it is in all industries. Belgium has no longer the cloth monopoly. Cloth is made in Germany, in Russia, in Austria, in the United States. Switzerland and the French Jura have no longer a clockwork monopoly. Watches are made everywhere. Scotland no longer refines sugar for Russia. Refined Russian sugar is imported into England. Italy, although neither possessing coal nor iron, makes her own ironclads and engines for her steamers. Chemical industry is no longer an English monopoly. Sulfuric acid and soda are made even in the Urals. Steam engines made at Winterthur have acquired everywhere a wide reputation. And at the present moment, Switzerland, which has neither coal nor iron, and no seaports to import them, nothing but excellent technical schools, makes machinery better and cheaper than England. So ends the theory of exchange. The tendency of trade, as for all else, is toward decentralization. Every nation finds it advantageous to combine agriculture with the greatest possible variety of factories. The specialization of which economists spoke so highly certainly has enriched a number of capitalists, but is now no longer of any use. On the contrary, it is to the advantage of every region, every nation, to grow their own wheat, their own vegetables, and to manufacture at home most of the produce they consume. This diversity is the surest pledge of the complete development of production by mutual cooperation, and the moving cause of progress. Why specialization is now a hindrance to progress? Agriculture can only prosper in proximity to factories, and no sooner does a single factory appear than an infinite variety of other factories must spring up around, so that mutually supporting and stimulating one another by their inventions, they increase their productivity. Part 3. It is foolish indeed to export wheat and to import flour, to export wool and import cloth, to export iron and import machinery, not only because transportation is a waste of time and money, but above all because a country with no developed industry inevitably remains behind the times in agriculture, because a country with no large factories to bring steel to a finished condition is doomed to be backward in all of the industries, and lastly because the industrial and technical capacities of a nation remain undeveloped if they are not exercised in a variety of industries. Nowadays, everything holds together in the world of production. Cultivation of the soil is no longer possible without machinery, without great irrigation works, without railways, without manure factories. And to adapt this machinery, these railways, these irrigation engines, etc., to local conditions, a certain spirit of invention and a certain amount of technical skill must be developed, while they necessarily lie dormant so long as spades and ploughshares are the only implements of cultivation. If fields are to be properly cultivated, if they are to yield the abundant harvests that man has the right to expect, it is essential that workshops, foundries, and factories develop within the reach of the fields a variety of occupations and a variety of skill arising therefrom, both working together for a common aim. These are the true forces of progress. And now let us imagine the inhabitants of a city or a territory, whether vast or small, stepping for the first time onto the path of a social revolution. We are sometimes told that nothing will have changed, that the mines, the factories, etc., will be expropriated and proclaimed national or communal property, that every man will go back to his usual work, and that the revolution will then be accomplished. But this is a mere dream. The social revolution cannot take place so simply. We have already mentioned that should the revolution break out tomorrow in Paris, Lyon, or any other city, should the workers lay hands on factories, houses, and banks, present production would be completely revolutionized by this simple fact. International commerce will come to a standstill. So also will the importation of foreign breadstuffs. The circulation of commodities and of provisions will be paralyzed, and then the city or territory in revolt will be compelled to provide for itself and to reorganize its production so as to satisfy its own needs. If it fails to do so, it is death. If it succeeds, it will revolutionize the economic life of the country. The quantity of imported provisions having decreased, consumption having increased, 1 million Parisians working for exportation purposes having been thrown out of work, a great number of things imported today from distant or neighboring countries not reaching their destination, fancy trade being temporarily at a standstill, what will the inhabitants have to eat 6 months after the revolution? We think that when the stores containing foodstuffs are empty, the masses will seek to obtain their food from the land. They will see the necessity of cultivating the soil, of combining agricultural production with industrial production in the suburbs of Paris itself and its environs. They will have to abandon the merely ornamental trades and consider their most urgent need, bread. A great number of the inhabitants of the cities will have to become agriculturists, not in the same manner as the present peasants who wear themselves out ploughing for a wage that barely provides them with sufficient food for the year, but by following the principles of the intensive agriculture of the market gardeners applied on a large scale by means of the best machinery that man has invented or can invent. They will till the land, not, however, like the country beast of burden. A Paris jeweler would object to that. They will organize cultivation on better principles, and not in the future, but at once, during the revolutionary struggles, from fear of being worsted by the enemy. Agriculture will have to be carried out on intelligent lines, by men and women availing themselves of the experience of the present time, organizing themselves in joyous gangs for pleasant work, like those who 800 years ago worked in the Champ de Mars for the Feast of the Federation, a work of delight, when not carried to excess, when scientifically organized, when man invents and improves his tools and is conscious of being a useful member of a community. Of course, they will not only cultivate wheat and oats, they will also produce those things which they formerly used to order from foreign ports. And let us not forget that for the inhabitants of a revolted territory, foreign ports may include all districts that have not joined in the revolutionary movement. During the revolutions of 1793 and 1871, Paris was made to feel that foreign ports meant even the country district at her very gates. The speculator in grains at Troyes, starved in 1793 and 1794, the sans-culottes of Paris as badly and even worse than the German armies brought onto French soil by the Versailles conspirators. The revolted city will be compelled to do without these foreigners, and why not? France invented beetroot sugar. When sugarcane ran short during the continental blockade, Parisians discovered saltpetre in their cellars when they no longer received any from abroad. Shall we be inferior to our grandfathers who hardly lisped the first words of science? A revolution is more than a mere change of a prevailing political system. It implies the awakening of human intelligence, the increasing of the inventive spirit tenfold, a hundredfold. It is the dawn of a new science, the science of men like Laplace, Lamarck, Lavoisier. It is a revolution in the minds of men, as deep and deeper still than in their institutions. And their steel economists tell us that once the revolution is made, everyone will return to his workshop, as if passing through a revolution were going home after a walk in the Epping Forest. To begin with, the sole fact of having laid hands on middle-class property will imply the necessity of completely reorganizing the whole of economic life in the workshops, the dockyards, the factories, and the revolution surely will not fail to work in this direction. Should Paris, during the social revolution, be cut off from the world for a year or two by the supporters of middle-class rule, its millions of intellects, not yet depressed by factory life, that city of little trades which stimulate the spirit of invention, will show the world what man's brain can accomplish without asking for help from without. But the motor force of the sun that gives light, the power of the wind that sweeps away impurities, and the silent life forces at work in the earth we tread on. We shall see then what a variety of trades, mutually cooperating on a spot of the globe and animated by a revolution, can do to feed, clothe, house, and supply with all manner of luxuries millions of intelligent men. We need write no fiction to prove this. What we are sure of, what has already been experimented upon and recognized as practical, would suffice to carry it into effect if the attempt were fertilized, vivified by the daring inspiration of a revolution and the spontaneous impulse of the masses. Chapter 17 of Agriculture, Part 1. Political economy has often been reproached with drawing all its deductions from the decidedly false principle that the only incentive capable of forcing a man to augment his power of production is personal interest in its narrowest sense. The reproach is perfectly true, so true that epochs of great industrial discoveries and true progress in industry are precisely those in which the happiness of all was inspiring men, and in which personal enrichment was least thought of. The great investigators in science and the great inventors aim, above all, at giving greater freedom of mankind. And if what Stephenson, Jacquard, etc. could have only foreseen what a state of misery their sleepless nights would bring to the workers, they certainly would have burned their designs and broken their models. Another principle that pervades political economy is just as false. It is the tacit admission, common to all economists, that if there is often overproduction in certain branches, a society will nevertheless never have sufficient products to satisfy the wants of all, and that consequently the day will never come when nobody will be forced to sell his labor in exchange for wages. This tacit admission is found at the basis of all theories and all the so-called laws taught by economists, and yet it is certain that the day when any civilized association of individuals would ask itself, what are the needs of all and the means of satisfying them, it would see that in industry, as in agriculture, it already possesses sufficient to provide abundantly for all needs, on condition that it knows how to apply these means to satisfy real needs. That this is true as regards industry, no one can contest. Indeed, it suffices to study the processes already in use to extract coals and ore, to obtain steel and work it, to manufacture on a great scale what is used for clothing, etc., in order to perceive that we could already increase our production fourfold or more, and yet use for that less work than we are using now. We go further. We assert that agriculture is in the same position. Those who cultivate the soil, like the manufacturers, already could increase their production, not only fourfold but tenfold, and they can put it into practice as soon as they feel the need of it, as soon as a socialist organization of work will be established instead of the present capitalistic one. Each time agriculture is spoken of, men imagine a peasant bending over the plough, throwing badly assorted corn haphazard into the ground, and waiting anxiously for what the good or bad season will bring forth. They think of a family working from morn to night, and reaping as reward a rude bed, dry bread, and coarse beverage. In a word, they picture the savages of La Bruyère. And for these men, ground down to such a misery, the utmost relief that society proposes is to reduce their taxes or their rent. But even most social reformers do not care to imagine a cultivator standing erect, taking leisure and producing by a few hours' work per day sufficient food to nourish not only his own family, but 100 men more at the least, in their most glowing dreams of the future. Socialists do not go beyond American extensive culture, which after all is but the infancy of a cultural art. But the thinking agriculturist has broader ideas today. His conceptions are on a far grander scale. He only asks for a fraction of an acre in order to produce sufficient vegetables for a family, and to feed 25 horned beasts he needs no more space than he formerly required to feed one. His aim is to make his own soil, to defy seasons and climate, to warm both air and earth around the young plant, to to produce, in a word, on 1 acre what he used to gather from 50 acres, and that without any excessive fatigue, by greatly reducing, on the contrary, the total of former labour. He knows that we will be able to feed everybody by giving to the culture of the fields no more time than what each can give with pleasure and joy. This is the present tendency of agriculture. While scientific men, led by Liebig, the creator of the chemical theory of agriculture, often got on the wrong track in their love of mere theories, unlettered agriculturists open up new roads to prosperity. Market gardeners of Paris, Troyes, Rouen, Scotch and English gardeners, Flemish and Lombardian farmers, peasants of Jersey, Guernsey, and farmers on the Scilly Ice have opened up such large horizons that the mind hesitates to grasp them. While up till lately a family of peasants needed at least 17 to 20 acres to live on the produce of the soil, and we know how peasants live, we can now no longer say what is the minimum area on which all that is necessary to a family can be grown, even including articles of luxury, if the soil is worked by means of intensive culture. 20 years ago, it could already be asserted that a population of 30 million individuals could live very well without importing anything on what could be grown in Great Britain. But now, when we see the progress recently made in France, in Germany, in England, and when we contemplate the new horizons which open before us, we can say that in cultivating the earth, as it is already cultivated in many places, even on poor soils, 50 or 60 million inhabitants to the territory of Great Britain would still be a very feeble proportion to what man could extract from the soil. In any case, open bracket, as we are about to demonstrate, close bracket, we may consider it as absolutely proved that if tomorrow Paris and the two departments of Seine and of Seine-et-Oise organize themselves as an anarchist commune in which all work with their hands, and if the entire universe refused to send them a single bushel of wheat, a single head of cattle,